The final argument of the term is Double Diamond Construction versus Farmers Cooperative Elevator. For the appellant, Double Diamond Construction, we have Mr. Chad Swenson, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the Appley Farmers Co-op Elevator, we have Mr. Roger Damgard, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Mr. Swenson, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court, counsel, justice of the court, good morning. It's my privilege to be in front of you this morning and appearing on behalf of Double Diamond Construction and its owner, Wilma Miller. Essentially, this is a case that arose from a construction site dispute between a general contractor, Randy Muller, and his subcontractor, Wilma Miller, Double Diamond Construction. The genesis of the dispute arose when the grain storage building that was at issue in this case that had been requested to be erected by Farmers Elevator Cooperative and had been contracted out to Muller Construction, the general contractor, was almost completed. In fact, we had submitted evidence at the arbitration proceeding that it was 95% complete. Judge Hertz, the arbitrator in this case, found that it was 90% complete. On the evening of October 6, 1999, bushels of grain were placed into the storage facility despite an agreement that the subcontractor, Wilma Miller, had with the elevator and the contractor that no grain would be placed in the building before completion. There is an extreme hazard in doing that, a structural hazard and a risk to employees. Previously, Ms. Miller had worked on a similar facility in Heron Lake, Minnesota, where a structure failed because the elevator placed grain into the building. So when this happened and she discovered it, she immediately contacted the elevator and Muller Construction and asked them to sign a liability waiver if they would not remove the grain from the building. They refused to do so. And in fact, on October 7th of 1999, Mr. Muller took it upon himself to enter into a separate lease contract with Yerke Construction to begin the project to its conclusion with approximately 5 to 10% remaining on the grain storage facility, independent of ever trying to work out an agreement with Ms. Miller. Subsequently, about a day or two after, Ms. Miller was fired from the project. Now, why this is all significant is because under her subcontract with Mr. Muller, she was still owed an additional $52,500 under the contract, and in addition to that, some additional expenses that brought her lien claim total to approximately $69,000. Now, this is an issue in this case, and she's admitted this. She did owe Yerke Construction some monies for rental equipment use, but she had calculated that notwithstanding owing those sums, she still should have netted about $50,000 on that project. What happened instead was Mr. Muller terminated her, never paid her the remaining proceeds on the project, and this dispute began. In federal court, this case was filed in February of 2000. It was filed as an action to enforce a mechanics lien, predominantly. What happened at the time was that Mr. Damgard was representing initially Muller Construction back in October of 1999, and in fact wrote to Ms. Miller on a couple of occasions expressing his client's position. The elevator at the time in the fall of 99 was represented by Mike McGill, an attorney from Beresford. After the lawsuit was filed, Mr. Damgard executed a waiver of any potential conflict between the parties, and he began representing both the elevator and Muller Construction. However, throughout the discovery process of the case in federal court, Muller Construction was always the predominant plaintiff, and the claims of the elevator always seemed to be a secondary issue throughout the federal case. A year after the building's completion, there was a partial collapse of the grain storage building in the area where Muller Construction employees were putting in the bolts to finish the 5 to 10% remaining on the project. There was an amendment to the answers and counterclaim at that time to assert negligence claims against Double Diamond. That also was an issue that was submitted to the arbitrator. At the arbitration proceedings, Judge Hertz, you've got an opportunity to review his decision, concluded after hearing testimony from 9 witnesses and a number of exhibits that the building was overfilled by the elevator and that there was not a preponderance of evidence to show that Wilma's employees, as opposed to the employees of Muller Construction, actually put those bolts into the facility. Judge Batty had issued a very brief decision on the question of summary judgment, which had been raised by both defendants in this case in federal court. He had denied summary judgment to the defendants, set the matter for trial in Rapid City on August 14th of 2001, beginning at 9 o'clock in the Rapid City Courthouse. Shortly after his decision denying summary judgment, Mr. Damgaard called me and asked if my client would be willing to submit these claims to binding arbitration. There were concerns about travel to Rapid City and distances involved and the cost. Obviously, we're not talking about claims that are running into the millions of dollars or even hundreds of thousands of dollars in this case. I told Mr. Damgaard that I did not have a problem with that, but I needed to visit with my client. I called Wilma and spoke with her about the arbitration. She was initially reluctant, but agreed to go forward with an arbitration proceeding. In addition to that, counsel for the defendants also suggested that we have Judge Hertz. I agreed that I thought that was a good idea. Judge Hertz is a respected, retired circuit court judge, and as we all know, there are mistakes and errors that can happen in arbitration. And it seemed wise to have Judge Hertz as the arbitrator because it seemed that the risk for mistake or error might be minimized by his presence as the arbitrator. So, with my client's somewhat reluctant approval, we agreed to submit this case to binding arbitration. We signed a binding arbitration agreement, which set forth the issues to be heard and also set forth the fact that the arbitration would be binding. The case was arbitrated in November of, I believe, 2001 before Judge Hertz. In February of 2002, Judge Hertz entered an arbitration award as well as offering a 10-page memorandum in this matter, which was very detailed and laid out very, succinctly and in detailed fashion his findings and conclusions in this matter. What Judge Hertz had done basically in his arbitration award was that he believed that 90% of the work had been done by Double Diamond Construction. He also knew that we had been paid $187,500 under the contract and were owed an additional $52,500. So what he did, not at our suggestion and not obviously the way we wanted it to be done, is he took 90% of the $240,000, came up with a sum and subtracted that from what we'd been paid, which produced a number of $28,500. Then there were some additional items that he did allow that were costs that I talked about earlier that we believe brought our lien claim up to $69,000. He didn't allow all of them. In fact, he allowed a fraction of them. But he entered an award for Double Diamond Construction of about $30,000 approximately. In addition to that, he did not find that we breached our contract, as alleged in the counterclaim, to Mueller Construction. He did find, however, that Mueller's employees equitably had done some work to finish the project and we owed them some labor costs. And there was a dispute on what those labor costs were because obviously there was never an agreement on what we were going to pay Mr. Mueller's employees to finish the project. Wilma testified that she paid $12 an hour to her employees. Mr. Mueller testified he paid $20. Judge Hertz used $15 as what he thought was a reasonable number. So Mueller was awarded some monies under the original arbitration award for the cost of labor that he had in finishing the project. The contract claim that Mueller had, as I said previously, was denied. We had argued to Judge Hertz as a matter of law that we believed that we were entitled to the full sum under the contract because, as Williston tells us and as there's authority throughout the United States to tell us, we believe that where a party prevents another party from performing under a contract, as we believed happened in this case and as we believe we proved in this case, we should be entitled to the entire benefit of that contract. We would have performed but for their unreasonable termination of us in this case. Judge Hertz disagreed, made his decision as he found it appropriate. The big issue that's before this court is the question of whether or not Judge Hertz exceeded, I believe, his arbitration authority in this case. Just briefly, a little bit of procedural history. After the arbitration award was entered by Judge Hertz, there was an initial attempt to submit the issue back to him by counsel for the defendants to amend it to fix what they believed was an error of law by him. That wouldn't be their phrasing of it. It would be that he exceeded his authority. I responded by arguing that I thought Judge Hertz was functus officio because he no longer had power to hear that matter after he rendered his decision until he was told by a circuit court to do so. Judge Hertz denied rehearing the issue at that time would have been, I think, in March or April of 2002, and authored a brief letter to us telling us he didn't believe he had authority or jurisdiction to do so. Application was then timely made to the circuit court in this case to vacate the arbitration award. Now, the grounds for vacation stem exclusively from SDCL 21-25A-24, subsection 3, that being that the arbitrator in this case exceeded his authority. We had an opportunity to present briefs to the circuit court. We had an opportunity last July, actually it's July of 2000, excuse me, Your Honors, to have an oral argument before the circuit court. The circuit court's conclusion that was that Judge Hertz, by what he claimed was refusing to hear the elevator's claims concerning damages, had acted in excess of the arbitrator's authority. Obviously, we disagreed with that position then, and we disagree with that position now. We do not believe in this case that Judge Hertz did, in fact, exceed his authority as an arbitrator when he entered his original arbitration award in this case.
Did the agreement have any reference, did the arbitration agreement have any reference to the elevator's claim?
The arbitration agreement itself did not specifically address the elevator's claim, but it did say that all of the parties agreed to submit the issues that were in the federal case to arbitration. And that would have included, and I think it was understood, that that included all of the claims and counterclaims of all of the parties. But it was a very general arbitration agreement. To that extent, Justice Meyer-Henry, it didn't state that that the negligence counterclaims of Mueller Construction, for that matter, were within the binds and confines of the arbitration agreement.
Did the arbitration agreement make any reference to the arbitrator being able to refer to the federal case and all the filings that were filed in the federal lawsuit?
It did not. It was not that specific, Your Honor. It stated that the issues that were in that case were being submitted for decision by this arbitrator, and that this arbitrator would enter a decision that was a binding decision upon these parties. And it did make reference to the Arbitration Act in South Dakota, but it was a very plainly drafted document which we believe covered all those issues. Otherwise, we wouldn't have submitted them. And I would point out to the court that Justice Hertz did hear and consider evidence on all of those claims, including the assignment claim. So he knew about all of the admissions. He knew about the admissions that Double Diamond made that they owed Jerky Construction some money. He knew about the admissions that the elevator made that they weren't pursuing any damage claims under their Rule 26A1 disclosures.
Was that argued?
Yes.
So you did argue that that claim was waived.
Let me strike that. No, in my pre-trial submissions, I did not argue that.
So that issue was, when you got Judge Hertz's decision in February.
Yes.
You must have said, "Wow, this is great! He came up with a silver bullet that I didn't even think of to use."
Partly true, Justice.
He did this sua sponte. He came up. He went through the record and found this procedural fault and came up with this sua sponte, didn't he?
He, in part, I think that's true. But you also have to remember, at the hearing, it was extremely confusing because Mr. Damgaard is supposed to be representing the elevator, but he's not putting on any evidence to support any claims of the elevator. All of the conduct by counsel and by the elevator itself, through its counsel, is indicating to us at the hearing that they are waiving this claim. Now, I have to honestly tell you, Justice, that no, I did not bring that issue before Justice Hertz, but I do not believe that he exceeded his authority by reaching that legal conclusion. What he did was an extremely thorough examination of the facts and the law, and he reached that decision on his own. What I would have preferred was what we submitted at arbitration, that we're entitled to $69,000 less 29, whatever the dollar amount is, to Yerke Construction, pay us $45,000 that we're owed. But he didn't agree with that either.
Well, then
it wasn't what we expected, but we knew that was a risk at arbitration. My apologies.
No, it's fine. I appreciate your finishing your answer. If there was no evidence put on the elevator's claim, how could the judge rule in favor of that claim then?
He originally...
I know he did.
Let me back that up.
How could he have
possibly... Let me back that up. What I said, and let me clarify, is that by agreement, and this is true, Mike Thompson came in for Yerke Construction to tell the judge what the dollar amounts were on the lien. We argued it was 21. They argued it was 29. That evidence did go before Judge Hertz.
Okay,
but
so
counsel...
I just want to understand this point. So the only dispute that the parties put before the judge was what is the right amount for the elevator, not whether they should be able to claim any amount.
Not the parties, because Yerke Construction wasn't a party.
Right, right.
But they came in with their own lawyer, and they presented some evidence on what those damages... I understand where you're going.
Okay.
But what's confusing is throughout, it appears that the elevator, from Rule 26A1 disclosures to the hearing, is a collateral party to this lawsuit, and that it's really Mueller Construction and this dispute that arose way back in that construction project in the fall of 99 that's hashing this out. Now, your points are valid, but the question is, did he exceed his authority or power? And I do not believe that he did. You've read our briefs.
He comes up with his own reason for taking the case out doesn't mean that that's a violation of his authority.
We agreed to be bound. We agreed to submit these issues. They were all submitted. They were all decided. Was it a surprise to all of us? Honestly, I think it probably was. We'd hoped for more money. I think that the defendants on their counterclaims hoped, Mueller hoped that they would get a bigger award, that their negligence claim would be proved. And like the trial, you know, things happen that you don't expect and anticipate. However, the issues are whether or not the arbitrator acted beyond what he was supposed to do.
Could I ask you,
sure.
If your position is adopted by this court, what becomes of the Yerke claim?
Nothing. Yerke's been paid. I saw that in their brief, and I thought that was, I don't want to say anything disrespectful. I disagree with that position. The only person that hasn't been paid in this case is my client, Double Diamond Construction and Wilma Mueller. Sad to say, despite doing 90% of the work as found by the arbitrator, we believed it was 95%, but Judge Hertz disagreed. Yerke's been paid. They were paid long before the federal case was ever started. They were paid $34,000 or $35,000. This arbitration award that's been amended that we may have to pay, should you affirm the amended arbitration award, will go directly back to the elevator, and will be
elevator
above and beyond. Yes, they did. Yes, they did, Justice. The elevator paid Yerke long before we ever filed a lawsuit, and the only party remaining unpaid was us. And what Wilma Mueller decided to do was to try to get payment for the work she did. And through this long process, we've come to you at that point, and that's what she sought from the beginning. And we agreed to be bound by the arbitration agreement. Judge Hertz, in my opinion, made a legal conclusion about these admissions that were made in the Rule 26A1 disclosures. He was aware of our admissions. He was aware of their admissions. And I think he came to the conclusion, well, one party admits they owe somebody some money. The other party on the record admits that they are waiving that claim. So if you're waiving it, I'm not going to hold you responsible for it.
You know, help me with the
sure, Justice Inner.
The federal disclosure rule. We don't have that same rule in state court now. Is that disclosure rule binding like admissions or anything of that nature under the federal rules?
It's an interesting question. It's a question I addressed more thoroughly in our reply brief than I did in my initial brief. I think this court has indicated that judicial admissions are binding despite the stage of the process at which they're made. I would argue that that would apply to arbitration proceedings, to Rule 26A1 disclosures, et cetera, et cetera. I found a single case. There's not much authority.
They only have the binding effect that an admission does, an answer to formal requests for admissions under the rules.
I feel personally, and I may be wrong in this, I feel that it does. I don't think that admission is any different than a party admitting as a hearsay exception to another party, hey, you know what, we're waiving those claims. Had they not made that admission formally, and had they made that admission informally, had Mr. Mueller told my client, I'm waiving those claims, had admitted that to her as an exception to the hearsay rule, and had it come before the arbitrator on the basis of that, I think that still would be a binding admission that he could consider. His decision about what to do with those admissions, I believe, as the arbitrator, is his decision. And I agree, it's an interesting legal question. And I agree that it's a question that you may have some disagreement about. However, I don't believe that it can be said that by making a legal conclusion that he made, that he manifestly disregarded the law. I don't think it was a clear and conscious rule that Judge Hertz was aware of. I think if he was, he wouldn't have decided the case the way he did. Moreover, there is no authority in their brief anywhere to tell us that admission, in fact, is not binding. Nowhere in their brief. Have they ever cited to a single case or provided any authority to lead to a contrary conclusion? I found one case from the district court in Massachusetts, and it is not a great case by admission. What it is it's a civil forfeiture case involving a kind of a collateral criminal action. And in that case, the district court, federal district court, and again, it's a federal court, not a state court, like your question posed. In that case, the federal district court said that since the civil Rule 26A1 admissions were going to be binding against the criminal defendant in that case, that I can't remember exactly the terminology. The impression from it was that admissions made in a civil forfeiture case are admissible in a criminal proceeding as well.
Your time has expired, Counsel.
Thank you, Justice.
Thank
you. Appreciate
the
time.
Before Mr. Damgaard proceeds, I failed to note that Justice Sabres has disqualified himself. The court has appointed the Honorable Robert Kim, Circuit Judge from the Third Judicial Circuit in Watertown, to sit in his place. You may proceed, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before we get started, could I ask a question? We've just heard counsel talk about the effect of the Rule 26 admission. It seems to me that after the admissions were made, the federal district court granted permission for amendment of the counterclaim. Is that the way things happened here? And was this claim, the Yerke claim, added after the Rule 26 submission?
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. What did happen was that the initial disclosures, which take place fairly soon after the case is commenced in federal court, indicated that the elevator had no claim, monetary claim, against Double Diamond. Thereafter, what happened was the elevator made a decision to purchase Yerke's claim from Yerke and pay Yerke off, and then it took that claim and asserted it against Double Diamond because, in fact, Double Diamond owed the money to Yerke. And when that happened, with leave of court, the elevator amended its counterclaim to include, in fact, a monetary claim against Double Diamond, and that's part of this record, and it is, in essence, the amended counterclaim of Farmers Co-op Elevator Association and Mower Construction. And, Your Honor, Count 3 makes it very clear. In fact, Count 3 is entitled Assignment from Yerke Construction and makes a monetary claim against Double Diamond.
If the arbitrator would have decided, rather than that the elevator had waived its claim, just denied them any damages, would we be here?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
So what's the difference?
Well, there's a huge...
Just because the arbitrator used the analysis that they waived it, what's the bottom line? Why would that be... I mean, go ahead and address that. I don't see the difference.
Your Honor, there's a huge distinction between an arbitrator making a mere mistake of law. For example, a situation where there's some esoteric UCC issue before an arbitrator. It's brief, the parties argue it, and ultimately the arbitrator just blows the decision. Blows it so bad that he earns a footnote in White and Summers saying, for a really bad case, read this. That is merely a mistake of law, and that is not grounds, clearly, for vacating an arbitration award. Now, contrary to that, and alternatively, we have a different situation here. We have a situation here that deals with whether or not the arbitrator exceeded his authority. And that is a totally different issue. And what happened here was that the arbitrator latched on to the Rule 26 disclosures, and he latched on to that issue in spite of the fact that if we go to the arbitration agreement itself, this goes to the heart of the matter, the arbitration agreement contemplates that the district court file is going to be submitted to the arbitrator. Well, discovery had been completed in federal district court, and what the arbitrator got, as Mr. Swenson said during his argument, was all the claims and counterclaims between the parties. What had been raised? A Rule 26 admission doesn't raise an issue in and of itself. We know that in lawsuits that the parties raise the issues. They raise them in what? In answers, in complaints, in counterclaims, in affirmative defenses, and by motion, and by argument. There wasn't a single pleading, there's not a single document in the federal court record that raises or addresses this so-called waiver issue. It wasn't.
So are you saying then that every time an arbitrator may apply the law incorrectly, as you allege it, would that be exceeding his authority then?
Absolutely not. I don't think when a mere mistake of law is a situation where an arbitrator exceeds his authority. But he does exceed his authority when the parties agree these are the issues that are before you, Mr. Arbitrator, and those issues are framed in these federal court pleadings, which we're giving to you. And those are the issues that are before you that you are to decide in this case. Now, there's no doubt, Justice Meyer-Henry, that the parties can, by course of dealing during the arbitration or by further agreement, expand the issues that might be presented to the arbitrator. But that didn't happen in this case. In fact, if you want a real true picture for what was presented to the arbitrator, keeping in mind that arbitrators are not circuit court judges, they're not federal district judges, even though they retired or they actually were, they are arbitrators, and arbitrators are different, because their authority derives only from what the authority the parties give them, as opposed to a circuit court judge or a federal district court judge who derive their power from many other places. So very specific. And if you go, for example, like most telling, if you look at the arbitration agreement, what it says is that, you know what? It says that I'm going to require each of the parties to submit a position paper addressing the issues in this case for arbitration. And in fact, both the parties did. And it's part of the record in this case. And the elevators is entitled Defendant's Position Paper. It addresses the counterclaim on the merits. It says we're owed X because of this, and we're owed Y because of that, and they're addressed. Interestingly, it doesn't address in any way any Rule 26 waiver issue. It doesn't address it because the issue was never raised in federal court by any of the parties, wasn't raised in the pleadings, and wasn't raised after the matter was sent to arbitration by any of the parties either.
But was the arbitrator free to apply the federal pleading rules to the pleadings that you presented to him?
No. I think the arbitrator was obliged to follow the arbitration agreement. And the arbitration agreement contemplated the issues that were presented by the parties in federal district court.
Why give him the pleadings then?
Because the pleadings frame the issues. But the parties have to raise the issues, and that's how they get framed.
Did he get all the pleadings or selected pleadings?
I believe he had the entire court file, and frankly, technically, the Rule 26 disclosures aren't filed with the court, just as now in our circuit courts, they don't want discovery any more than the federal district court clerks want discovery. So technically, the Rule 26 disclosures really even weren't part of the, quote, court file, because the parties just exchanged those.
Well, how did Judge Hertz get that then?
Oh, we gave him virtually everything. We gave him depositions and those sorts of things. He requested those things, and we gave him what he asked for. And that's how he got them, Your Honor. But getting back
to... So the only reason he got this Rule 26 thing is because he requested it.
In essence, it was a broad request under his arbitration agreement, and yes, that was deemed to be part of his broad request. And ordinarily, a court would never ask, for example, for a deposition testimony for a trial unless the parties decided it was relevant.
You know, you've made your point on the question of law, and I think I understand what you're trying to say, but what if Judge Hertz had simply overlooked this counterclaim? Excuse me, not overlooked it, but as a matter of fact, it just forgot to rule on it. Now, would that kind of mistake of fact be reviewable as exceeding your jurisdiction?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think it's clear under some of this court's prior rulings, including Anat, that an arbitrator has to decide the issues that are placed before him. That's why you go to arbitration. We want you to decide these issues, Your Honor. That's what happened in this case. This counterclaim, this amended counterclaim, was one of the issues placed before the court, argued by the parties. He said, Judge, we want you to try this. We want you to decide this. That's why it's there. And in fact, he exceeded his authority in this case by not addressing that claim on the merits which was put before him, and by addressing a claim that was never put before him. This so-called Rule 26 waiver defense was never put before him. Was never put before the federal court, never put before the arbitrator, never argued by the parties in the arbitration or prior to the arbitration. So yes, in answer to your question, I think if you don't address an issue that you're given, which in essence he didn't do on the merits in this case, you do exceed your authority. Because that's why you go to arbitration, to get the issues resolved.
Of course, here he did address it. Really, I mean, his decision is quite clear. I think he speaks to it 3 or 4 times. And so it's a question of whether he was ruling as a matter of law or whether he overlooked it.
He didn't address the issue on the merits. He disposed of the issue based on what he perceived to be a waiver defense, which was never raised by the parties and never submitted to him. And to really emphasize that, I think you need to look at the position paper that was filed in this case. It's called a plaintiff's statement of claims that was filed by Double Diamond in this case. And if you look at that statement of claims, you're going to find on the last page, interestingly, page 9, in 2 places, Double Diamond says, yes, we owe the Yerke claim. There's no doubt about it. We owe it. We're admitting to liability. We think our liability is $21,000, not $29,000. So they truly conceded that they owed the money. Pretty hard for them not to concede it, because in this case, Double Diamond's mechanics lien, which mechanics liens have to be sworn when they're filed. Double Diamond's mechanics lien basically says not only we're owed certain amounts of money on this project, part and parcel of their mechanics lien is in fact money that they owed Yerke. In fact, the money that they owed Yerke was the reason why Yerke filed a mechanics lien on the same property. And what the elevator did was, we want to get rid of this mechanics lien of Yerke, so we're going to pay that off, take an assignment of Yerke's claim, so now we have a claim back against Double Diamond. So it's pretty hard to say, well, you know, we don't owe that, when in fact, in part, your own mechanics lien is based on that liability. So in any event, as to the merits of the counterclaim, conceded for the most part as to liability and mostly as to damages. But most telling and most remarkable is, no matter how you look at this position paper, and I don't care if you tear it into a million pieces and paste it back together any way you want to, there's not a single argument, there's not a single word in here that addresses any kind of a Rule 26 waiver defense as being before the arbitrator, because it wasn't before the arbitrator. It wasn't raised by the parties, it wasn't an issue in the federal district court, it wasn't an issue framed by the pleadings, and it wasn't an issue framed by the parties when the, you know, for the arbitration and prior to the arbitration or during the arbitration. Now, I want to clear up a few things. One thing I want to clear up is, why did counsel for Yerke come in and try try in arbitration the elevator's counterclaim against Double Diamond? It did so by agreement. I'll tell you what my strategy was, very frankly. Yerke had sold us, in essence, its mechanics lien amount, the amount that supported its mechanics lien. When you file mechanics lien, you do so under penalty of perjury. And my theory was, listen, I'm coming in and try this. If the arbitrator ends up giving me quite a bit less than what I paid for it, I'm going to go back to Yerke and say, well, listen, your lien statement wasn't totally honest here, and I don't expect that I should have to eat this. So the easy way of handling this is the way I thought it was handled. I said to counsel for Yerke, you try it to the arbitrator, and we did so with Mr. Swenson's approval and with the arbitrator's approval, and then if you end up not getting what you should get, not getting the full amount I paid you, well, then it won't be very hard for me to revisit a little adjustment in the purchase price. And that's the way that was done. There certainly wasn't any confusion about the fact that there was an amount owed on the counterclaim. It's freely conceded. Yes, we owe that amount of money to Yerke. We owe money to Yerke. We think it's 21, not 29. Nothing confusing about that whatsoever.
Was the mistake here that Judge Hertz made is that he wrote a decision telling you why he made the decisions. Had he just done a general decision, denied this claim, granted this claim in the amount, you wouldn't be here.
Well, You know, sometimes being thorough is helpful, and sometimes it's not, Your Honor. And many arbitrators don't write very thorough decisions. That's true. Bottom line, in this case, if an arbitrator exceeds his authority, an arbitration award can be vacated. Here, we have a situation where the arbitrator exceeded his authority two ways. One, he addressed a waiver issue that was never presented to him, never raised by the parties, never argued by the parties. And further, he failed to address on the merits a claim that was presented to him, and not only was presented to him, but was conceded as to liability by the other side, and conceded as to damages for the most part. Now, clearly, when Judge Severson vacated the arbitration award, he did so correctly under these circumstances and should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Damgaard. Mr. Swenson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
If I can briefly begin by discussing the position papers, Justice Meyerhardt had asked about the scope of the arbitration agreement. Both sides were asked to submit position papers. One of the issues that was part of this matter, as the position papers make clear, was the question of the assignment. That issue was presented in the position papers. It was argued to Judge Hertz. It was considered by Judge Hertz. There was evidence pro and con to Judge Hertz on that issue. And it's true, as I've said before, in our position paper, we conceded that we owed Yerke Construction some money. We disputed that it was $29,000. We thought it was $29,000. But in our position paper, we also believed that our net was going to be $48,000 to $50,000. We believed our claims were $69,000. Judge Hertz disagreed. He made a decision that was not consistent with what the defendants wanted and was not consistent with what we wanted. And the simple matter is that if we did make admissions or concessions in our position paper, which would be binding, the same admissions and concessions which would be binding were made in the Rule 26A1 disclosures. So when Judge Hertz is sitting in this case as the arbitrator, he is seeing admissions, which I find to be remarkable, that a party to a lawsuit would admit in a Rule 26A1 disclosure that they are not making any damage claims. Judge Hertz had those admissions before him, and he had them under his consideration. In addition to that, he also had our admissions on that issue that, yes, we owed them some money. And what he did with both of those sets of admissions was that he made a legal and potentially factual conclusion that although we admit we own some money, they admit that they're not bringing any damage claims. And on the basis of those facts, he reached a legal conclusion that they were waiving the concession that we made concerning monies that may have been owed to Yerke Construction. Whether that was a mistake of law, whether that was a mistake of fact, is not a sufficient basis for taking the arbitration award away from Double Diamond Construction that was originally entered. Arbitrators, as the legislature has espoused its preference for, and as this court has expressed its preference for, have binding authority to decide those issues submitted to them, regardless of whether they make a mistake of law or a mistake of fact. The critical question becomes is, was it a manifest disregard of law, where there is a known rule that an arbitrator decides to ignore? And that's even been argued in this case. And clearly, the facts of that arbitration memorandum decision and the facts of this case and the ambiguity about Rule 26A1 disclosures and the fact that there is no case authority cited to show, other than the one case I found from Massachusetts, that they're not binding admissions, I think strongly suggests that there was not a known rule of law that Judge Hertz intentionally ignored when he reached the legal conclusion that, in fact, those claims had been waived, as the defendant, Farmers Elevator, said they were waived in its Rule 26A1 disclosures. So I wanted to address that point. Not to beat a dead horse, but I think it's so abundantly clear that this was a mistake of either fact or application of law by this judge at most. What this arbitrator did was he made a legal conclusion based on experiences that he's had in years of trying cases and considering laws that those admissions were binding and constituted a waiver. Wrong or right, he made that legal conclusion. When this matter came before the circuit court on an application to vacate that original award, the circuit court did what it should not have done and what the case law tells us it should not have done. It substituted its own judgment on the question of whether that was wrong or right for the judgment of the arbitrator who had reached the decision that he, in fact, believed it to be a waiver. And I think it's well settled that it is not appropriate for circuit courts who do not sit, as you justices do, in reviewing decisions of lower courts. It is not appropriate for those courts, and the Nelson case from Montana makes this clear, to decide these kinds of issues and substitute its own judgment for the judgment of the arbitrators. And I believe that's exactly what happened in this case. It's clear to me that the circuit court did not agree with the legal conclusion that was reached by the arbitrator in this case concerning that waiver. Agree with or disagree with that decision, it's binding. We agreed to be bound. When this question was raised by the defendants concerning arbitration, we all knew the risks. We all knew the potential for error. We all knew or should have known the rules that go with arbitration decisions. And we agreed to be bound by those rules. And we have an arbitrator who drafts a very detailed and thorough arbitration decision. And in that decision reaches a conclusion that we have to live with that may be mistake or may not be mistake. I still am not convinced it was even a mistake. I haven't seen any authority, any case law, that tells me that those admissions are not deemed to be a waiver. That hasn't been brought before this court or before me, and I'm a young lawyer, so I can miss a lot of things, so I maybe just don't know the answer to that. However, there isn't anything to suggest that he did make an error, but at most, that's what he did do, was make an error, if in fact those admissions were not binding, if in fact they did not waive the claim. Despite what Judge Hertz found and decided, that at most is a mistake of law or fact. That's what it is at most. It is not the basis for finding that an arbitrator exceeded his authority. In our briefs, we referenced a couple of cases that may be most on point. One is the Omelet decision that this court decided. The other is the Nelson case that I referenced in my brief from the Supreme Court of Montana. Both of those cases give us some insight into what is exceeding authority. And what they both tell us is that where an arbitrator decides issues that are not submitted to the arbitrator, that is exceeding authority. I also cite the Jamison and Harris case from Texas, where a Texas appellate court, I know it's not binding authority, they deal with a situation where there was a refusal to hear evidence on a fraud in the inducement claim. And the court concluded that that refusal and the application of substantive law that may have been an error does not constitute grounds for vacating the arbitration award. Now, in the Supreme Court of Montana decision, and in this case, Omelet decision, what we were considering in those cases is a situation where an arbitrator is asked to decide certain issues. And what the arbitrator did in Omelet is decided not the two questions before it, one being whether or not the parties had reached a binding agreement on the sale of real property, and the second being, if not, what the rental use value of the land was, I think beginning March 28th of 1974 going forward. Those were the issues in that case that were submitted to the arbitrators. What the arbitrators did instead of deciding those issues, even telling us anything about their opinions on them, instead they simply divided the land, 80 acres for one party, 80 acres for another party. Clearly, they decided issues not submitted for them and therefore acted outside of the agreement. That is not the situation in this case. I firmly believe that Judge Hertz was very well informed of the assignment claim. He knew of all the admissions. He references them in his opinion. He knew what he was doing, and he made the decision, and he believed that that decision was the right decision. Those are not the facts in Omelet. In addition to that, the Nelson, Montana Supreme Court case, why I cited that case to you is it's a situation, again, where that court acknowledges, even citing the Ascon construction case that this court decided, that court, the Supreme Court of Montana, even acknowledges that exceeding authority by an arbitrator is a situation where the arbitrator decides issues not submitted to him or her as the arbitrator, not a situation like we have in this case. And if I can, I'll wrap up here quickly. I appreciate your patience and the opportunity to be here before you today. The language in that case, the Nelson case, tells us about the sanctity of arbitrations and why there's a preference for them as a resolution to disputes. And in that opinion, the Supreme Court tells us that it is not the position of the circuit courts when reviewing arbitration decisions to sit as this court does when it's deciding whether or not a trial court committed an error of law in a trial proceeding. Instead, we are to give deference, as this court knows, to the arbitration award. There is a presumption that that award is correct, and to respect the integrity of that deference and the presumptions, in this case, we would ask that this court, as the Montana Supreme Court did in the Nelson decision, reverse the decision by the circuit court to vacate the award with instructions that the original arbitration award be instated. There has been talk about, in the brief, about frustrating the principles of arbitration if you're to affirm the existing amended arbitration award. And in my brief, my reply brief, I responded that I think what's most frustrating...
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Justice.
Thank you. Court will be in recess.